Hi, ladies, and welcome to the Story Night podcast. I'm Jessica Campbell, and stories are my passion. It's my honor to host this podcast where real women share real stories of real hope. Each episode features one woman sharing her personal story with you. Too often, we fall into the traps of comparison and judgment, but what if we took the time to hear each other's real stories? Let's remember that we all have a story, and our stories matter. We're so glad you've joined us on this podcast journey. May you find hope and encouragement in this episode's story. Hi, ladies, and thank you for tuning into this episode of the Story Night podcast. If this is your first time finding us, welcome. We're so glad you're here. We recommend checking out episode 46, as that'll give you the most up-to-date information about our nonprofit, introduce you to our board of directors, and give you the history and vision and purpose of Story Night. This is a place where women of all different backgrounds, experiences, ages, personalities, etc., share their real, authentic stories through events and podcast episodes. Some of the stories are extremely heavy. Others are more lighthearted. As you listen to these episodes, you might laugh or cry or both. The point of sharing stories is to bring encouragement, sometimes inspiration, and to let listeners know that no matter what they're going through, they are not alone. And they can find hope and healing. And when we tell our stories, we build community. We practice the art of listening. And no matter how different we are, we can find a bridge of connectivity. My guest for this episode is my dear friend Leah. And this is actually part two of her story. So if you missed part one, pause here and go back and listen to episode 62. And now, ladies, I want you all to prepare yourself for a very emotional episode. As you know from the first part of her story, Leah has two children, but only one is here on Earth. Leah bravely decided to share the story of her firstborn, Henry. Although he only lived 6 months after his birth, his story matters and it has impacted so many. So Leah, thank you for your willingness to share this. Right. In just a moment, I'll have you recap your first episode and then share the rest of your story. But I wanted to start this episode with something very sweet and meaningful. Henry's Little Free Library. In honor of Henry, Leah and her husband placed a free little library in front of their home in hopes that the books would bring families together to read and create lasting memories. You can follow Henry's Library on Instagram at Henry's Little Free Library, and we'll put the link in our episode notes. Leah, I love how you've honored Henry in this way with the library, and you're honoring him also by telling his story. One of the things I love about stories is how interconnected they are. Henry's story intersected the lives of countless others during his short time here, and he continues to impact people today because you're keeping his memory alive. And to further honor Henry, we are publishing this heartfelt episode on July 11th, Henry's birthday. So happy birthday, Henry. And Leah, thank you. In your first episode, we left off right when Henry was transferred to a new hospital for a surgery. And before you start the second part of your story, will you give listeners a recap of part one and maybe also share some of the ways the community came alongside your family?
Yeah, I meant to include some of that, and it really resonated as I left all of these little moments throughout our time in the hospital with Henry. So Henry was born at just 24 weeks and 6 days gestation, which if you don't know what that means, that's, you know, 15, 16 weeks early or 4 months early. So you can imagine how difficult that was. He weighed only 14 ounces when he was born. They consider that a true micro preemie. And we spent months, days, hours, every moment in the hospital, in the NICU with him. He went through countless medical challenges and procedures and setbacks, but he continued to grow and fight, and he became our little comeback kid. On the day he was born, July 11th, 2017, a friend of ours in Atlanta, an old neighbor, wrote this poem for him, and I wanted to share it. It's called Song for Henry. Beneath the vast Oregon sky, heard to the world an infant's cry, a child so ready for this earth that he hastened his birth. And for all to see, into our hearts is Henry. Small though he did enter, but no less a contender, he will succeed unbound from this new world found. and soar from love's high, boldly Henry shall fly. That's our friend Michael Moncrief wrote this for him. One of the things that really kept us going in those months in the NICU was the community that carried us. We lived in McMinnville. We were in the hospital at Providence St. Vincent, which is about an hour and 15 minutes away. So some of the things I didn't share were all of those people that came alongside us during our NICU journey. There were so many God moments that reminded us we weren't alone and allowed us to keep fighting. Weekly meals and practical support, people came alongside, and friends in McMinnville organized a community meal train. They'd pick up from people and deliver us a cooler full of meals so we could focus entirely on being with Henry in the hospital. We had a little home away from home. A friend heard what was happening and came to visit us in the NICU. She was in the process of finishing a renovation on a little guest house in their backyard, and they lived about a mile and a half from the hospital. At the time, we had been staying in the hospital's guest house, which was $50 a night, and so it was like not viable for us to continue staying there. So we were able to move into her little space, surrounded by beautiful trees, and it became like a little refuge or retreat for us every night when we would leave the NICU. We would wake up in this little treehouse. We stayed there for nearly 5 months. Many people started fundraisers and offered financial support. We're still paying for everything at home, our mortgage, our everything, and not able to work. So a couple of people I want to highlight, Lindsay Woodard and her brother Jeff organized a wine tasting fundraiser in McMinnville. Earl Kramer Brown donated wine, his time, and did the tasting and offered cases for sales. And they raised more than $3,000 to help support us. My wine distributor at the time, I had been a sales person for a winery, and my wine distributor on the other side of the country in Pennsylvania passed a hat around their sales meeting and raised over $3,600. These are just from sales reps who are selling wine on the other side of the country. One of the sales representatives from that team knew about a charity that supported families who were in medical housing and applied for a grant for us for $1,500, which paid the entire amount that we owed the hospital guest house. So you just see these little moments throughout. Another amazing thing was all the encouragement we had from strangers across the country and the world. A friend shared Henry's story publicly, and hundreds of strangers sent letters, notes, and messages of encouragement. They were called love letters, and they came in a big box to us. Those love letters became a source of strength during some of our hardest days in the hospital. They arrived sometime in November. And while Henry was fighting for his life, an entire community was fighting alongside us. And looking back, we see so many moments of provision, generosity, and hope woven throughout our entire story.
And what incredible examples of ways to come alongside somebody. This topic comes up all the time. How can you help, whether it's cancer, whether it's a divorce, whether it's a financial crisis, whether it's a medical crisis, whether it's the loss of a loved one, no matter what the story is, I think most people have very genuinely good hearts and they say, let me know if you need anything. How can I help you? And most of the time, the people in the midst of the suffering, they can't even see straight. They have no way to answer that.
Right.
Or even know how to accept the help sometimes. And so just be with somebody, just be willing to come next to them and say, you're suffering. I'm just going to stand next to you and be next to you during your suffering. Maybe there's nothing to say.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's nothing you can do, but just to be there and be willing to be in that uncomfortable space, to be willing to feel helpless, to know that you cannot fix their problem, but you can be next to them and you can be willing to just sit there.
Sometimes that's all you need is that moral support.
Yeah. Yeah.
A friend.
So we left off right before Christmas and you had just moved to a new hospital and Henry's getting ready for surgery.
So we left our hospital home at Providence St. Vincent in an ambulance and headed to Randall Children's Hospital where we didn't know any of the nurses. We didn't know the medical team. We didn't know anyone there. And then we quickly were ushered into all these meetings with surgeons and doctors and people who wanted to evaluate Henry's situation. And at this time, you have to understand, he originally born at 14 ounces. At this point, he's around 9 pounds. So he looks like a baby. He doesn't look like a little squirrel anymore. And so these people don't know our whole story. Sure, they could read the chart, but who has time for that whole chart? That's a lot. They know, you know, the brief recaps, but I think when you mentally see someone that's a big little baby, you know, he looked chubby and chunky and cute, it's harder to see the whole story, even if you're a NICU nurse. So I felt like we had to advocate a whole lot more there for Henry's care and everything that was going on. So it was a little bit of a struggle on my part, feeling helpless. I didn't have my support of our medical team and nurses around us. So they sent us to a catheter lab, which is where they take a, you know, they take something up through your vein in your groin or your leg and go all the way up to your heart to evaluate what's going on in your heart. So Henry, little baby, they did one. They didn't get what they needed out of it. So they did it a second time. So it delayed our surgeries a couple weeks. So this is kind of in that week before Christmas and after Christmas. We had two procedures like that. We had a nice little Christmas together there, and it snowed on Christmas Day, which was really kind of sweet. And then he had the second cath procedure in the cath lab, and they found that he had a little hole in his heart. And so they're able to put a little kind of plug in that spot to see if that would give him enough help for his heart to support his lungs and everything else. And maybe he wouldn't need the tracheostomy, which was, you know, a good thought. We were very excited about it. Helpful. I really liked the cardiac surgeon that did all of that work for us, but it just wasn't quite enough. So on Christmas Eve, they put him on a CPAP machine again, and it was just what he needed to get like a little extra support. On Christmas Day, he was doing so much better, so they took him back to his high flow oxygen, and we got to spend a great time with him. And then New Year's came. It's now the first week of January, and I'm supposed to start back to work, so it was a little tenuous. And they scheduled his big surgery for January 8th. So it was like January 2nd. We knew we had like about a week before the big surgery. So we were just soaking in the time with him, holding him, doing everything we could. And the day came, and he got carted away in his little, you know, surgical bed, screaming because he hadn't eaten in 24 hours, because even little babies don't get to eat before surgery. Isn't that sad? Try to explain that to them. So they did the trach procedure and the G-tube, which is how it's like a gastro tube that goes right into your stomach so that you could feed him directly through it and bypass all of the, you know, issues with lungs and anything and aspiration. They did both of those procedures at the same time. Everything went fine. He came back to his room and he was heavily sedated this whole week. So it was really a difficult week for us in the hospital anyways. And I was trying to just cling to the fact that he needed to be heavily sedated so that he wouldn't move, you know, the surgical place and mess anything up. The morning of January 11th, which was my sister's birthday, we did a couple of cute little videos. And, you know, I remember seeing them later and thinking, I should have known something was wrong. And this is, I think, innately in us to do, is to like reevaluate everything that we, you know, in hindsight, what could I have done to advocate better for my son who was heavily sedated and I didn't see what was going on. So I came back from a short work meeting that day because I had to start working again and got there around 2 o'clock, and the nurse had a funny look on her face and she was like, I can't get his temperature. I'm like, what do you mean? That doesn't make sense. Yeah, his temperature's really low. And I didn't understand that. I didn't know what that meant. I guess, you know, a low temperature means, you know, you could be possibly going into septic shock or something else post-surgery. So we immediately knew something was wrong. Kyle was down in McMinnville working at our home, trying to get a little bit of his work in. And I called him and said, you need to come back. I don't know what's going on. He didn't understand that it was so dire and waited a couple of hours before he left. Meanwhile, many people came in Henry's room and were talking to me and looking at him and doing some tests. And I had this feeling that I had never had the whole time we had been in the NICU. This was it. I had that feeling. And I knew something was really wrong this time. I didn't give up hope, but I just knew something was really wrong. So his nurse was working to try to get, you know, some temperatures, called the doctor. I hadn't seen that perinatologist that day, and I didn't really know the doctor that was on his rotation that day. I just was waiting with the charge nurse, listening to her tell me it could be this, it could be something else. It's going to, you know, we're going to do what we can and it could be okay. And I tried to cling to that while I waited for Kyle to show up, but it was just, it was desperate times. And so I was lying on the couch in his room, trying to just shut out the noise of all of the tests and procedures and beeps and everything, monitors that were going off, and to escape the panic that was rising in me because I knew something was really wrong. We all try to find even the smallest piece of hope in those moments, like something could change. And I'm sending every prayer I could think of. Mentally, I couldn't pick up my phone and call anyone. I was just so panic-stricken. I didn't know what to do. So I waited. But deep down, I knew something was happening. It wasn't logical what was going on in the room. I watched it as if I was floating, not there. I felt out of body for sure, and I knew something was terribly wrong. And then I heard a familiar voice out in the hallway. Dr. Sweeney, the same doctor who had insisted I held Henry all those months earlier, the first time. That was the first time we had him as our doctor, and this was the last time. He wasn't even on call for Henry. He was on call for another patient. And it felt like another element of hope. He came in, I heard his laugh in the hallway, and he came in and said, "What's going on?" And they filled him in on everything that they were doing. And he went into battle. And you could see it. He shifted from the doctor that's talking to parents and patients and whatever to a surgeon fighting for a child. And he did everything he could possibly do over those hours. Kyle showed up and we both just like watched in horror and also in awe of what was going on around us. Like, what is happening? The medical team, you know, just went to work and they were doing everything they could. And at some point, I remember them asking us to leave the room so that they could get a central line, which is they put a line directly to his heart so that they could get meds and fluids, whatever they needed, closer and faster. And they were trying everything. So they made us leave the room because it's kind of like a surgical procedure. And we were out of the room for probably an hour and just terrified. And I think Kyle called my parents. I don't quite remember. I remember we went out to the car and just sat in the car because we didn't know what to do. You know, it's hard to be in a hospital at that point. By the time we got back in there, you know, we're talking to Dr. Sweeney. He's like, "I don't know for sure, but it feels like he's probably developed a sepsis, some kind of a septic infection that we didn't catch." And so they kept trying all these interventions, but nothing was really helping. And at this point, it's probably 2 a.m. He's like, "I'm going to need you to hold him again." That night was truly the hardest night of my life. But of course you want to hold him. I hadn't held him in days because he had been, you know, laying after his surgery in this bed, you know, not to be moved. I wanted to hold him. But at this point they had IVs of so much fluid in him. I think he weighed at this point like 12 pounds on my 9-pound baby. It felt like holding this heavy weight. It was so strange. It didn't feel like him, but I held him. And Dr. Sweeney says his organs are starting to fail. There's really, unfortunately, nothing we can do. My parents showed up and they were there. But there's nothing like that moment when your child is literally dying in your arms. I can't even look back at those times. I know the nurse took pictures of us holding him the last time, and I still haven't looked at the pictures. I just can't.
It's one of those things I can't go back to. And Dr. Sweeney, who wasn't even on call for Henry and had been there since 2 o'clock the previous day, was still with us. He was there until 7 a.m., hours after Henry died. He was there, crying and holding us in a way that I have never had a doctor care as much as he did. And it just, well, awful and painful. It was one of those moments that I will forever be grateful for, that it was him and that he was there, because his care and concern for Henry and for us was just palpable. Like, you knew he was there for us. But leaving the hospital that day, packing up months of Henry's things, washing my baby after he died and wrapping him in a blanket and handing him off to people that took him to the morgue. All of it is just unthinkable. I don't know if I've ever told that part of the story. I just kind of skip past it when I talk to people, but it was so hard. And we left the hospital that day with a carload full of stuff, baby clothes, all of the things we would have had in a nursery because we lived in the hospital. And we drove back to the Ronald McDonald House and then had to load up all of our stuff there. We had to do all these things because we couldn't stay there. And it's just another thing that after you've gone through so much, you wish you didn't have to think about those kind of things. And we had been up all night. And I remember Kyle saying, well, I need to eat something. It felt weird, but we went, got something to eat. And we sat there in silence. And it just really hits you. Life will never be the same. It really won't ever be the same without Henry. About a month later, we had a memorial service for Henry at Providence St. Vincent because the chaplain, Melinda, offered their services. Laura, who played the harp for him in the hospital, was there. All of the nurses were there. Hundreds of people showed up to support us and be there. To remember a baby that most of them didn't get to meet, you know, or hold or see. Henry's story really just resonated with so many people that he was a fighter and he fought to the very last day. And those people made it possible for us to survive. I had friends that flew in from Atlanta and stayed and surrounded us that week. And we had to move forward. You know, it's really, really difficult. The grief over a child is probably, it's not one I would ever want anybody else to experience. And it's not one most people can understand. There are so many things people say or do to support, but it is the hardest grief you could possibly have. People say things like, at least, ... Don't ever say that.
Yeah. We've had this conversation on so many topics, so many women, so many different types of stories, and pretty universally they all say, please don't ever say at least.
We can all agree that's probably not the best choice of words when you're talking to anybody.
The intentions are good because I think you're trying to find beauty in the darkness. You're trying to find something to be grateful for in the midst of all of the pain and anger, maybe the resentment, maybe the bitterness, all of the emotions that understandably come.
Yeah.
And it's not that it's bad to be grateful for things. I mean, I've heard it in your story as you shared, being grateful for the doctor, being grateful for the people, being grateful that you got to hold him. I know those, that exists, that you are so thankful for so many of the things. But when somebody else comes into the story and just says, well, at least blah, 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 there's a sting to that.
Yeah.
And it's not the best choice of words.
Well, and especially when you're grieving, I entered a club that I never wanted to be a part of, the dead baby mama club. I was a first-time mother who didn't have a baby. I was, you know, it's a childless mother. It's really hard to explain it. In those early months, I felt so displaced from myself. And I think most women who have been through miscarriages and other things can understand and relate, even if not fully. Like, there's this stigma around all those talking about it. But I literally had a 6-month-old baby. And I, you know, had pumped milk for 6 months. And I was a mother. But I had nothing to show for it. I had no one. And then you find so many people ask really personal or what they think are just surface level questions in situations that you shouldn't have to answer. Like the checker at the grocery store, you know, oh, do you have kids? Well, I'll tell you, yes, I do. That's a really hard question. And at the early stages after Henry died, I wanted to make people as uncomfortable as I felt when they asked me those questions, because it just was so hard to be confronted by it with strangers, you know? And I wasn't at that place where I could say, I have a child and he's not with me, because I shouldn't have to say that to the checker at the grocery store. So I would say something, yeah, yes, I do, but he's dead, and make people really uncomfortable. And now years past, you know, learn to relate and talk to people differently. Mm-hmm. But I was so new in my grief and trauma from it all that I really just couldn't be around people. And if you know me, I'm a people person. So that was really hard too. So I laid on the couch a lot that year. Yeah. And Kyle and I really clung to each other and supported each other through our grief. He struggled so much. And watching him just and his emotions was really hard for me too. So we went to counseling and we had the most wonderful therapist who walked us through those really difficult years. And, you know, I knew I still wanted children and I had to get to a place where I felt healed enough to let someone into my life again. And we also knew we had to wait because of my previous cesarean at such an early week and the way they did that. We had to wait at least 18 months before we could try again. So, you know, over those years of like trauma therapy and counseling, and we did EMDR treatments to help me like not think about that last night every day of my life. Because you wake up every morning and you think, my baby's dead. And it's just, every morning it was jarring for the first year, you know? I should be doing this. I should be doing that. Mm-hmm. He should be
this age.
This age.
Right. He and you should see other people in the community with children or little boys that would have been that same age.
And you do and a you lot think, of comparison at that time.
Why do they have theirs?
Yeah.
Why did I lose mine?
Yeah.
Why don't I, all the whys.
All the whys and all the, like you said, bitterness surrounding the fact that my miracle didn't get to stay, you know? That's one of the things I've said to you over these years. And honestly, I do feel in such a better place now, but, you know, it's 9 years since Henry was born. 9 years. That seems unthinkable. I don't see 9-year-old kids now and think about Henry, which is really weird. He's my forever baby. I mean, I see when you brought Luke home and he was so little, I saw Henry there because that's how my brain and body remembers him, you know, and feels him. I can't imagine him as a 9-year-old anymore.
And I have to say how special our friendship has been with that. As you know, I'm a pretty sensitive person.
Yeah.
I'd always be so concerned that, you know, is any part of our story triggering? Is it hard for you to, you know, hold our little NICU baby who is still here? And his story is completely different.
Yeah.
But you've always loved our boys so much and just been such a part of their lives. So, I mean, I see so much of your healing where,
yeah,
you know, so often you hear the phrase, I can't imagine. We've talked about this before, that you think, what would I do in that situation? How would I feel if that story was my story? And what would trigger me? And how would I, and most of the time you can only guess.
Yeah.
If you haven't lived it, you can try to imagine, you can make a guess, you could try to think, well, how might this person feel or think? Maybe I can be thoughtful with my words or my actions or, you know, just try and have that compassionate thought before you do or say anything.
Empathy is huge when it comes to this. Not just sympathy, but empathy. Right. And trying to relate to someone and be in their shoes a little bit goes a long way.
I liked the phrase you said, healed enough. Because very rarely are we
healed
perfectly.
Right.
But we can get to a point of healed enough to move forward, healed enough to hold somebody else's baby,
right.
Healed enough to fill in the blank. And you've been a very treasured friend, and the invitation has always been there for you to share your story, because the very first time I met you, we were sitting on the floor at a kid mommy's play group, and I mean 2 hours later we had shared both of our stories. It was very immediate, you know, and I was like, this is my kind of girl. We did not just start with a like, oh hi, how are you, where are you from, what's your, I mean, we dove right in.
I was able to do that at that point though because of someone we mentioned but have not talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Henry sent a treasure to us, and in so many ways I see him in her, and in so many ways she is so other than him. When Vivian was born and when I was pregnant with her, I just knew, I felt it, like I just felt it the whole time, like she was such a big part of our healing. And not that one child heals or replaces another, but it felt like Henry really truly sent her to us. And I remember when naming her, like it was such a huge thing to me, like has to have a meaningful name. And I thought of Hope and honoring Henry in some way. And so, you know, my natural brain was going down H names, and I looked through a bunch, but none of them stuck. And then one day I was like, you know, I'm going to look up the name Vivian and see what it means. And it means full of life or
and
alive.
She is full of life. That girl is light and life personified.
In some ways, too much, but that's okay.
But we love that. She is.
And if you've met her, she's told you what her name means.
Oh, yes.
And about her brother, I'm sure, because she talks about him.
And yeah, she is so special.
Yeah.
Truly an incredible.
I think children
human.
Have a way of healing us and healing our hearts with their words, their bluntness, their ability to face hard things, their determination to not look away when something happens. You know, kids are naturally curious. If you tell them, oh, you know, I had a baby that passed away, they will not understand what that means. And they'll ask you more questions. But if you tell them, I had a baby that died, oh, why did that happen? And you have a conversation with a child that is almost more meaningful than you could have with an adult, because they would shrink away from it or say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Right.
And I read a book recently that was about a woman who had lost her son at a different stage. But there's a quote that stuck with me. She said, I'm in this position often of having to make other people comfortable about my loss. My grief, you know, dealing with other people's awkwardness around my loss and my grief and my pain and suffering. And it struck me so strongly, because we often say, oh, it's okay. When somebody says, I'm sorry, you say, oh, I had a son, he died. Oh, I'm so sorry. It's okay. Why? It's not okay. But kids don't do that. They don't look away. They don't apologize for things that they don't have to. You know, they just say, they ask the questions. And in some ways, I love talking about Henry. So if a kid asked me, oh, why did he die? You know, I don't know that there's a real reason for that. But here's what I do know. He gave us so much hope. He showed us what he could do, that he was a fighter, that miracles happen. And even though my miracle died, you know, and the death of my miracle was really hard for me, he brought us another miracle. He somehow made it possible for us to love again and raise a child. And, you know, though panic stricken when she was young, I slept with my hand on her chest when she was a baby, you know, just so many things that when you know about the things that can happen, you find out about all these other things that can possibly happen. And then you are terrified of all of those things as well. But Vivian taught me that she was determined to live and that we named her appropriately. And she continues every day to say things about Henry that surprise me, talk about, you know, love and life and everything in between, and bring us more healing. Regularly, you know. Mm-hmm.
Children have a really incredible way of doing that. They don't clunk around their words.
No. I appreciate that about them.
Yeah.
They're real and authentic. Yeah. Like you said, you know, so much of us as we grow up are too polite or too scared to say mm-hmm. something.
You know, at this moment, I kind of wish I was a 5-year-old child because I feel like a 5-year-old child could probably close this episode better than I can.
For sure.
But we do like to wrap up every episode, whether they're lighthearted or really heavy or full of grief, with encouragement, with hope. That's our tagline, real women, real stories, real hope. And it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be all tied up in a bow. It doesn't mean every single thing is rainbows and sunshine all the time now. But having gone through what you've been through, it's been 9 years. I know there's been some healing.
Of course.
And you said healed enough again. If you were to give just a sentence or two of encouragement, hope, or even just recognizing other people's pain also, what would you say to other listeners?
I think showing up for people is so important. And, you know, I learned through this situation that those people that show up really matter. They don't have to do anything particular or special necessarily, but showing up and being there, asking the questions, talking about them, asking their name instead of the, oh, I'm so sorry. Maybe it's, you know, oh, tell me about Henry. That means so much to me. And I remember in the days and weeks after he died, a meal train was started. And I learned years later when Vivi started preschool or somewhere in the middle of her preschool years that her teacher, Heidi, who I did not know, had dropped off a meal at our house after Henry.
Wow.
She came to our house later and went, I've been here before.
Oh my gosh.
And she had no clue about Henry or anything else. She just got sent a link and came. So it's like the interconnectedness of community and how we show up for people is what really matters. Mm-hmm. You know, sitting, like we said, sitting with them. Don't put the onus on the person grieving to decide what you can do to help. Just do something. Nobody wants to hear, oh, what can I do to help? Because we all talk about the mental load all the time as mothers. We all have so much that we're thinking about. We can't tell you what to do. Just do something. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be specific. Just think of something on your own and do it.
Yes. Well, Leah, thank you. Thank you for being willing to do this. And you've been so gracious to connect with so many women in the community. So if anybody listening to this wanted to connect with you,
for sure,
you can reach out to us at Story Night and we will get you connected to Leah and you can meet her at our events and all that, all of those things. But, you know, just in closing this episode, I'm not even going to go into all of the other things that Story Night does or mention the next event. You heard all about that in part one of Leah's story and you can hear all that in our future episodes. We hope you come back for more of these stories.
Yeah.
But I'm just so grateful for everybody who makes this outreach possible, for the women who are willing to bravely, boldly, and authentically share their stories, no matter what type of story they are.
Yeah.
For the businesses that support us, for the individuals that support us, for the people who listen to this, for the women who come to the events. Our hope is to build community, remind everybody listening that you matter and your story matters. And sometimes it's the story of somebody else. In this case, it's Henry's story.
Yeah.
And it is such an honor to be your friend and know Henry, even though I didn't know you at that part of your life. But you have opened up that chapter of your life to me that I feel like I did know you back then.
Yeah.
And I feel like I get to know about Henry.
Yeah.
And that is a treasure. So I want to thank you
as well
for letting me be a part of your story and for sharing it with everybody listening.
Thank you for letting me talk about Henry.
Absolutely. I believe with all my heart that you will hold him again.
I know, and I can't.
And I know that I don't mean to say that lightly and just like pat on the back feel better. But just for anybody out there listening who has lost somebody, that's just from my heart, just something I believe in, something I want to share, and I wish I could give each of you listening a hug. And Leah, I'm going to give you a great big hug.
Thank you.
And thank everybody for tuning into this episode of the Story Night podcast. We hope that you were blessed. We hope that you were encouraged and that you come back and join us next time for the next story.
Yes.
Until then, remember, you have a story, your story matters, and you are not alone.